the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And a very good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour broadcasting today. Once again, the fourth day we're broadcasting from the Sydney Royal Easter Show. And we'll also have some other news from outside the show. We'll hear about a big fine or an agreement to pay a fine from the water watchdog from out at a winery at Wellington. We'll have the details of that shortly, and also we'll give you the details of the President's Medal, which was announced here at Sydney Royal yesterday. But right now we're joined to talk about district exhibits. Now, we spoke to one of the show legends earlier in the week who has been involved in the district exhibits for about 70 years. But we're joined now by the overall winner. Northern Districts exhibit was the overall winner again this year. And we're joined by Brad James, who's one of the organisers. Congratulations and well done.
Thank you very much, Michael.
And I gather that this isn't your first rodeo, so to speak.
No, it's actually my 10th year at the show working for the Northern Districts, and my 5th year as either co-manager or manager of the district display and judging.
And how many wins?
We've won over that period of time probably 7 in all.
Right.
But over the last 5 years we've won 3. And the other 2 years, they didn't have the judging, so we're pretty proud of that
record. Because of the flooding and COVID?
One for the COVID issue, and then secondly the flooding where nobody could get any produce down.
Okay, so you're in the sights. Now, how close? It was super close this year.
It was a very tight fight this year, and we managed to get ahead by 7 points.
7 points over
11,560.
Wow, it can't get much closer than that.
Well, it's good, and it was a tight scoring across all of the districts, so it was a real honour to come out in front.
So, and you were ahead of Central Districts, and
yes,
they won Best Display.
They did.
And they certainly put a lot of time into their display.
It's a spectacular display, I've got to say.
Yeah, but you were thinking more that you got over the line because of the produce.
Yes, I think we're very lucky. We have a great breadth of produce suppliers that have given us high-quality produce year after year. And I think that's probably the major contributor to our wins over the last couple of years. So we're very pleased for them and very, very proud of the result.
Yeah, and so is it because of the sort of rich, fertile nature of your region, do you think, or what?
I think we're lucky that we've got contributions from both sides of the ranges. We have coastal, where we've got sugarcane, we've got tropical fruits, and then across the other side of the border we've got grains, we've got grasses, but particularly our wool. We were pleased that we won the overall wool prize this year, and just as an aside on that, between the wool managers, they have an award which is a can of flag ale beer on a plinth, which is proudly displayed on our display this year. So,
Well, that's amazing. So, and I guess, is it a challenge for you, for Northern Districts and district exhibits generally, to get new blood in, to get younger people in?
Yes, it is, Michael. And it's probably one of the things that all of the districts are not necessarily struggling with, but it's a constant
activity. It's a constant
activity.
Worry.
Yeah. So, yeah, getting young people in is a high priority for all of us. We're lucky enough we've had a couple of young people come and work with us this year, and hopefully that'll perpetuate further down the line, and they'll tell their mates and they'll want to come along and help out as well. So,
and winning a prize at the Royal is a prestigious thing, like it's a major thing, and you actually use it as a marketing tool as well.
It's one of the advantages for all of our producers. They're able to put in their shop window or put on their front gate that they've not only contributed to the Sydney Royal Easter Show, but they've been successful at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. And hopefully for them, it gives them a bit of a marketing advantage, a bit of a point of differentiation with other providers. A good example of that is that this is the first year we've won the Ham and Bacon Overall Trophy, and John Hearns in Bangalore is now able to hang proudly in his window that he's been the first Northern Districts provider to win the Ham and Bacon Trophy. So,
right. I think that our reporter, Kim Hone, has interviewed him in the past. I seem to remember that.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Take us through the length and breadth, because your display and the produce, there is a huge variety that you've got there. Probably more than anybody else.
It is an enormous variety. The judging catalogue that we have to adhere by breaks up the produce into about 35 different categories, and then about 120 different products within those categories that you have to put forward for judging. And then,
right, that's really complicated.
It gets very complicated and becomes a huge job. But we have such a good team that have knowledge of their products, which of those products need to be put forward for the best result for us. And as we said before, 7 points.
We
did a pretty good job of picking which ones to put forward. So yeah, it's a significant task, and it's one that we take very, very seriously, because we're defending our producers' reputations.
And also an important part of it, I mean, I know Central won for the display, but the important part is, you know, you want to get the display looking as good, and it has to have a certain theme to it, doesn't it? You try and get a theme going.
Every year we have a different theme. Each of the districts are able to select their theme, and then the skill then is to build a display that communicates the theme that you've selected, and that's part of the point scoring as well. It's how well you put the display together to communicate that message.
And how are you going to win it next year?
Same amount of determination.
Have you already started planning?
We have. Yeah. We have. Our president, Brian Winter, who's gone back to Glen Innes day before yesterday, is going up to Cropper Creek to collect cotton for next year's show.
Is that
so
right?
So it all starts before this one ends.
Started already.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that's because it all depends on when the harvest seasons are for the different produce. So it's not just a matter of, 2 months before the show we've got to go and collect. We're all driven by, and it's the same for all of the districts, that we're driven by when the harvest seasons determine when the produce are available. And then we've got to store those produce so it's still in prime condition when we bring it down to the show.
Yeah, well, that's right. So it's a logistical exercise as well.
It is. And it's lucky we've got, again, the members of our team that have the expertise to know how to store it properly so that it maintains the quality of the produce.
But how many people do you need in a team to do it properly?
We have a team of probably anywhere between 40 and 50 people that work at different stages over the period of the 12 months. And it's people with a broad range of skills, from builders who help put the design together to our preserves lady Jenny Burrows does a wonderful job of managing our preserves, our wool people. So we have different areas of expertise, and we're lucky enough that people have the ability to make the time to do it for us.
Yeah, well, that's right. And obviously the commitment there as well, because it's a significant time commitment.
It is. And I think they do it because they love to do it, and they love to make a point of their produce being competitive, so that when they get the wins, they're able to, as we said before, have the bragging rights associated with that.
Yeah, and you were saying about the marketing and the bragging rights, and how important is that? I mean, in terms of you're out there spruiking it.
I think it's significant, and we do get feedback from our providers to say that, you know, it's a real advantage for them when people come looking for...
It's a dollar value on it too.
It is. For them, it's the reward they get for the effort, and the recognition, I think, is a really important strategic point for them for their ongoing business activities. And as business, you need a point of differentiation in any business, I think, and this gives them that point of differentiation.
Brad James, appreciate your time on the program. Congratulations again. Three wins out of 5 years.
Three wins out of 5 years.
Okay, so you'll have a target on your back for next year.
Yes, I think the pressure's on, Michael.
The pressure's on. Brad James from Northern Exhibits there, the winners, the overall winners this year by 7 points out of 11,000. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 14 past 12.
Hi, I'm Ashley here at the Sydney Royal Easter Show competing my horses, and I'm here with the New South Wales Country Hour.
Well, let's talk about the President's Medal now, a very prestigious prize. A cheese made from raw sheep's milk has won the 17th President's Medal at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. Procora Dairy won Australia's most prestigious food prize from a semi-hard cheese called Yarrowa. But just a few years ago, it was in fact illegal to make cheese from raw milk due to health concerns about serious life-threatening diseases like listeria. David Claughton reports from last night's event.
The President's Medal Dinner is the night of nights for food and drink producers in Australia.
The winner is Pecora Dairy.
Pecora Dairy beat five finalists from around the country, including beef, chicken and pork producers and another cheesemaker. It was an emotional Michael Caine who accepted the award.
What makes the President's Medal really special is that it rewards farmers for how they farm, not just what they farm. So, for instance, there's a whole bunch of commentary out there that might be talking about what we should eat, that meat might be bad or dairy. And in many ways, it's a very unsatisfactory question to ask, what should we eat? When the far greater, the more important, the more intellectually curious question is, how was it farmed?
Pecora keep 40% of their property as habitat for native animals. They share renewable energy with neighbouring farmers, while Cressida Caine, one of the founders of the Kiama Farmers Market, was also recognised for her dairy cocoon project, which helps other producers create their own food brands. She paid tribute to the support their businesses had from the Royal Agricultural Society, which provided them with a lot of early recognition and supported Michael to apply for a Churchill Fellowship to study cheesemaking overseas.
And that's had a profound difference on our business, his study with raw milk cheese, and his ability to disseminate that information to the wider community is very, very important. So thank you, RAS, and thank you so much for this honour.
The Caines worked with health authorities to work out a system to license raw milk cheese production and became the first in Australia licensed to produce it.
We were the first in Australia to be licensed to make a cheese that doesn't require any sort of pasteurisation. And the great thing about that is it means that it reflects the whole farming landscape, from the lactation cycle that the animals are in to the season, the microflora that is around, the composition of the milk. So this sense of place and season comes through in the cheese that we make. And to give you a good example of that, no two batches should be exactly the same because they're reflecting what's happening on the farm.
But it's a risky business, isn't it, Cressida, because people get fined for illegally producing raw milk and people die. Even like in New York, there was someone that pleaded guilty to producing a raw milk cheese that killed two people in the state. So you've got to be really careful.
Yeah, producing raw milk is quite different from producing raw milk cheese. The more raw milk cheese that we make is a real scientific process. It's certainly not a hit and miss process, and we went through a very rigorous process with scientists to ensure that the cheese making parameters that we have in Australia in order to make a raw milk cheese are such that there is absolutely no question that eating a raw milk piece of raw milk cheese from Australia is very safe.
And what do you think this will do, Michael, for raw milk cheese producers, that level of recognition for that kind of a product?
There's not a lot of raw milk cheese producers in Australia.
So I was reading three others, is that right? And you've probably trained them.
There is. There's only about three others. It's incredibly difficult. There's an incredible amount of paperwork and bureaucracy to get through. But I really encourage cheesemakers to make the effort, reach out if they need assistance. Let's get some more raw milk cheeses into the market because they show the Australian story. They allow us to make particularly Australian cheeses that the consumers appreciate.
Raw milk cheese wasn't the only unusual finalist in this year's list. Mountain Culture is a craft beer company based in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales. The brewer is American DJ McCready, who with his Australian wife Harriet have seen phenomenal growth in their business. That's despite dealing with terrible fires in 2019 and then the pandemic, which shut the doors of their Katoomba business for a second time.
It was a bit of a mess in the beginning, you know. We were doing everything we could. We were just relying on like a few customers who had bought from us before, taking email addresses, calling them, getting their credit card numbers, punching it manually into our point of sale system, and then putting a 4-pack of beer in the mail and sending it out to whoever it ordered.
A 4-pack of beer.
It was a bit clunky. But, you know, we did that for about a week. My wife built a makeshift Shopify website. we were really lucky during that time. The craft beer folks really didn't have much else to do besides drink and then talk about what they were drinking and specifically talk about what they were liking drinking. Yeah. You know, all of a sudden we started hearing people in Melbourne saying, wow, this brewery in the Blue Mountains is really cool. All of a sudden people in Brisbane saying, oh my gosh, I've tried this beer from the Blue Mountains. It was phenomenal.
So you geared up, haven't you? I'm like, I heard a stat that you'd started out producing 60,000 litres and you're now producing 8 million litres?
So, yeah, our original brewing capacity was 60,000 litres in a year, and now we can actually produce 60,000 litres in a day.
Now, the other thing we've been hearing about lately in that Four Corners program that talked about the major supermarkets and the major brewers and their foray into the craft beer section, right? So they're major companies, they're not craft brewers, but they're making beers that look like a craft brew and sometimes blatantly just making it up in the marketing. How is that affecting your business?
Yeah, that's a bit ridiculous. And their processes or what their processes are, like, I guess where I stand, I always just really trust that the Aussie consumer, the end of the day, has a discerning palate. And we can create a better product that they can at the end of the day. And like, in my opinion, that's always what will rise to the top. So though it's annoying that those things are happening for businesses like ours, I still double down on what's always been our core focus, which is creating the best product we can. And I know that I can outcompete them any day of the week.
That's DJ McCready from Mountain Culture ending the report from David Claughton from the Sydney Royal Easter Show and the announcement of the President's Medal, which of course went to Pecora Dairy, which we've talked to them a number of times here on the Country Hour over the years. It's coming up to 22 minutes past 12.
My name's Chris. I'm here at the Royal Easter Show and I listen to the Country Hour.
Now let's talk to some of the guys that have been involved in the Big Bush Barbecue, because I'll get them to tell you a bit about it, but I'm joined now by Lewis Dorney and also Andrew Smith, who are from Buller Dealer, involved in the Big Bush Barbecue. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks for having us, Michael.
Thank you for coming along. Now, it's quite competitive. A lot of these show societies really want to get involved in the Big Bush Barbecue. Why is that? What does it do for the society?
It's just a good thing for our show. It gets our people down here for a day out and helps us with putting events on for our show, make a bit of money to help us keep going along.
Yeah, when you're talking money, what sort of money are we talking about? Is it a significant fillip for your
Yeah,
society?
So I think Gresford set a new record last week selling about $7,000 worth of sausage sandwiches. Now, I'm not sure that we'll be competitive with them today, but certainly most shows are expecting to make, you know, $1,500 or $2,000, and it's terrific this year. The RAS Foundation's matching the first $1,500, which is a great boost to rural shows.
Right, it is indeed. And, yeah, as I was saying, a lot of them clamouring to get involved, really keen to get involved in it.
Yeah, no, it's good. Gives some people a reason to come down out of our area for a day to get, like, when they usually wouldn't come, they'll come to do the barbecue and stay a couple of days to see the show, so it's good.
Yeah, and you were mentioning the money, so what do you think the money will be used for in Buller Dealer?
So I think there's two things for us. One is it will allow us to continue to improve our facilities around our grounds, and also give us the opportunity to bring new and different entertainment to the people of Buller Dealer. We're a town of 1,000 people and, you know, on average bringing around 2,000 people in the gates each year. So great to put on some new entertainment for them as well.
So it wouldn't be used for any sort of new facilities as well?
Yeah, quite possibly. We're always looking at opportunities to improve our facilities and our grounds because along with our local show, it's also, you know, our grounds support a lot of community events and visitors to the area as well. So great opportunity to reinvest in the grounds as well as provide new entertainment for showgoers.
Yeah, okay. So, and how many people would you have involved in the show society? Would you have, you know, as sort of volunteers, people that are keen about it, keen and interested in it?
We probably would have 30 or 40 volunteers over the weekend, just to come in and help out to keep our show rolling, yeah.
And tell us about Bulladealer as a community. Like, is agriculture a big part of it? Is it, you know, was it tourism? What is it?
Yeah, we're a bit of a changing town at the moment. Historically, we've been an agricultural town. Chicken farms, dairy farms, beef and a big timber milling industry in town. But over the past 5 or 10 years, we've really seen a shift in the town, a lot of new entrants to the town, and it's really changed the fabric of Bulladealer. But, and, you know, I guess following on, it's terrific to see a lot of those people joining as volunteers and getting involved in show weekend.
And it's in halfway between Sydney and Port Macquarie, really?
Yeah, roughly. We tell people we're halfway between Newcastle and Foster, so on the mid-north coast, just in the middle of the Great Lakes, so a beautiful area to visit.
Yeah, and you were saying that there has been a shift or change in sort of the demographic and maybe in agriculture too. What's brought that about?
Yeah, I think so. Look, we've certainly seen a lot of people looking for the tree change, as we saw in a lot of regional areas throughout COVID. A lot of new homes getting built in Bulladealer, a lot of people shifting in potentially in the latter half of their lives and careers. And it's also, I think it's made the town a little bit more vibrant. We've got new shops opening in the main street, which is the first time in a very long time. So, yeah, the town's shifting for sure.
Mm. And you were nodding there. You were saying it's been good for the community. This influx of new people, and you've seen the town move ahead.
Yeah, our show is the biggest weekend of the it's the biggest event of the year in the town, and brings people to town, books the caravan parks out, and just really good for the town to get people into a small town. Yeah.
So how many people would turn up at a typical Bulladealer show?
We would get like between 1,800 and 2,000 people. So yeah, it's a pretty good little number for our town. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're gonna get a dollar each from this bush barbecue event at least.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a terrific bonus to the show. And as Lewis mentioned earlier, it's terrific. We've got hardworking volunteers that go about their lives quietly and help give to others on show weekend. So it's lovely to get them down here to Sydney for a day or two and get to see the show while turning a few snags at the same time.
That's right. Always good to turn a few snags. Well, I'll let you get back to it. You're probably busy. Thanks for joining us on the Country
Pleasure,
Hour
Michael.
Today.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having us.
No worries. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's coming up to 27 minutes past 12.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
How many people in the audience actually do ride a horse? Is there many horse riders? One? Couple? No horse riders here? One couple? Any horse riders here? None? No, the non-horse crew? All right, so it's pretty cool. I love when there's non-horse riders in the crowd because you get to learn a little bit of the best animals in the world.
You're listening to the Country Hour, and it's coming up to 27 minutes past 12, and we were talking about Bulladealer there. They're saying that they used to have a lot more dairy cattle in the region, a lot more dairy farms, and just farms generally in that region. Talking about dairy cattle, I understand that the dairy showing is underway at the moment. We're joined by Luke Michaela from Milk Barn. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks, Michael. How are you?
Very well, indeed. It's a great day. Lots of people milling around here in the Food Dome, which is where we're broadcasting today, right in front of the displays, the Central District and also the Northern District, the overall winner. So, Milk Barn. Organisation is a little bit different, isn't it? You're sort of trying to value add in the dairy space where others maybe don't.
Yeah, look, we run a dairy out at Camden, but we also, as a sort of side shoot to the dairy, run a bit of an education business on the side to educate kids about the dairy industry and where their food comes from. And then we sort of extend that here into the show to do demonstrations. We make cheese and skim milk and butter and things like that in a demonstration throughout the show.
And how important is that to get the message out about agriculture and food and good food too?
Well, I think it's so important because as a society, and even working in agriculture, I know a lot about the dairy industry, but I know nothing about growing sugar or anything like that. And I think we've become so far removed from our food production that it sort of becomes a danger to society in a way. So if we can bridge that gap a little bit, which is at the end of the day, that's what the show's about, it adds value to everybody.
So you're saying the food security issue, so you think that that is something that is sort of at the back of people's minds these days? When we had COVID, there were people that were worried about that big time.
Look, that's exactly. I think at the moment with interest rates and all the stuff that's going on in everybody's lives, you know, it may have moved back in people's main priority. But I think one thing with COVID, and it's sort of disappointing to always keep bringing it up, but it did bring the important things in life to the forefront. And I do think that knowing where your food comes from, how it's produced, and everything about it is something that should be important to everybody.
And also the keynote about that is the quality of Australian food, the quality of Australian dairy. In fact, the President's Medal went to cheesemakers as well this year at the show. So I guess getting that message out there too is important too, because people aren't necessarily aware of it.
No, that's exactly right. And I think things like the President's Medal to showcase the artisan type producers across all the industry is so important, because it's hard sometimes for those little guys to break through and get the attention that they absolutely deserve.
Mm. And also they're then the harbingers for others in the general food production as well, you know, because they're the elite and they're something to aspire to.
That's exactly right. And one of the things I know with the President's Medal, it's just not about the quality of it, but it's all about the way it's produced, the sustainability and all the rest of it. And that's just as important nowadays as what the quality of the food is.
And when the kids come and see you and you're doing the educational tours, what are the things that they ask about? Do they ask about the environment? Do they ask about animal welfare? You know, what are the things they're asking about?
It's all that wrapped up in one. So we go around to schools and we get questions, you know, like, you know, about the methane and production in cows, and about asking cows for consent to milk them and all this sort of stuff. And I suppose it's something that, as a producer, you've always got animal welfare on the forefront of your mind and
the
environment.
If you don't milk them, you're in trouble.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But I think they get just as much out of what we're explaining to them as we get insight into what's in the consumer's mind by being able to interact with them. So it's learning on a two-way direction.
And do you think the message is getting out there, or there's still a way to go?
Oh, look, I think...
with some of them, there isn't.
I've been doing the show here, the Milking Barn at the show here, for 13 years now. And for 13 years, we've been asked the same questions, because there's new people coming in, you know, to the show, new kids, new generation of people. It's going to be a never-ending classroom, I think.
Mm. But I guess for agriculture generally, that's a signal that, you know, the information has to get out there too, at a more broad level across the Australian population.
Look, that's right, and I'm pretty critical sometimes of the ag sector. We tend to close the gate a little bit, and you know we it's important, but we use biosecurity as a way of stopping people to come and visit the farm and learn about it. But at the same time, we need to have that open communication and dialogue with the consumer, so they understand why we do things. You know, I know sometimes things can look bad from the outside, but when you get to have the conversation about why we do things, how we do things, there's always a reason why we started doing whatever we're doing, and it's 9 times out of 10, it's for the better of the product that we're producing.
And we actually had that, those sentiments were foreshadowed on the program a couple of days ago, and when we were talking to the pig producer, who was saying he's in the Barossa Valley, but he says his farm's an open book. He wants to have people come through and look and see how good it is. He runs a tight ship, he said.
Yep.
He said it's important to have the general public going through and having a look.
Look, absolutely, because the only way you can build trust is to be able to show what you're doing and have people ask the questions that are important to them. And then we can start talking about the technologies that we're using that to enhance animal welfare and the quality of the produce, because we're always looking for a better way of doing things.
And by and large, generally speaking, farmers don't have anything to hide.
No, that's exactly right. And look, sometimes the farm's not always the safest place. We've got 2 kids that run around our farm, and they've got tractors and trucks and moving bits and pieces. But we have people out to our farm, and we go out to schools 4 days a week during the school term just to show what it is that we do on the farm.
Yeah, so yeah, it's keeping that communication going, keeping that openness going, keeping the trust, the social license, all
absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely, yep. No, that's exactly right.
Yep, Luke Michaeliff, look, appreciate that. I know you've been doing some displays and whatever and talking to the kids, so I'll let you get back to it, but appreciate your time on the program today.
Thanks, Michael. Catch you later.
It's coming up to 27 minutes to one.
You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Time to get some news headlines now. Adam Storey's there. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The Northern Territory Chief Minister says the two-week youth curfew that's been imposed on Alice Springs will be extended if the government finds it to be effective. The government announced the curfew yesterday. They've also sent extra police to the town following severe violence this week. The National Anti-Corruption Commission has struck its first blow with a former employee of the Western Sydney Airport project charged with allegedly asking for a $200,000 bribe. Federal police arrested the former employee yesterday, alleging they solicited the bribe while negotiating a $5 million contract for services at the airport, which, of course, is still under construction. And they've been bailed. They'll appear before the Downing Centre Court on April the 18th. The chair of the peak body that oversees the independent school sector has stepped down. That comes after revelations he allowed a convicted child sex offender to remain on its board. John Ralston has resigned from the board of Winona All-Girls School in Sydney, meaning he becomes ineligible to stay on as the chair of the association. And it comes after Mr. Ralston let Dr. Peter Cullen MacArthur remain on the board of the AIS. After disclosing in 1995 he was actually convicted of sexually assaulting two female patients. The federal opposition has signalled it may eventually back the government's immigration legislation after it unsuccessfully tried to ram it through Parliament this week. Labor rushed the bill through the House of Representatives, but it got blocked in the Senate by the Coalition, which has sent it to a committee, and there'll be a vote on that in May. A rescue crew has been airlifted into bushland southwest of Sydney to search for a man who's now been missing for almost 2 weeks. Darren Banks left his Macquarie Field home on March 15th to go bushwalking in a national park near Bargo. He was reported missing 4 days later when he failed to return home as planned. Now, they found a car at Starlight Trail at Wattle Ridge a week ago, and they're concentrating the search in that area. And finally, the cash transport company Armaguard has been given till the end of today to either accept or reject a financial lifeline to avert insolvency and to keep cash flowing to major businesses. Apparently the major banks, Supermarkets Australia, Post and the retailer Wesfarmers proposed a $26 million package last week, but Armaguard has yet to receive us, but the consortium is yet to receive an answer from Armaguard. Now, as a result of that, Coles has already paused Armaguard services for the pickup and delivery of cash until the 5th of April.
So cash no longer king.
Cash no longer king. It's even sending the cash companies broken.
but apparently that has been happening for a while, that they are concerned about the reduction in the amount of cash that's necessary. Some of those security companies have been in a bit of dire straits.
Yeah. But obviously,
how much cash have you got in your wallet now?
About
not enough.
It's not even in the wallet. It's like $4.50 in loose coin.
Because I very rarely carry cash.
No, I don't carry it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You only spend it if you carry it.
Well, that's it. You see, yeah. This is the thing. Yeah. Or the kids grab it.
Or
yeah.
It's.
Watch out.
It's there for the taking.
It's there for the taking, that's right. I saw it, I grabbed it.
Yeah.
I grabbed it, conquered. Yeah.
Sorry.
Thanks for that. Oh, that's the other thing. You haven't heard anything about the China wine thing. We're hearing that the Prime Minister might make some announcement soon. You haven't heard anything on that about the China?
Don't ask me questions I don't know the answer to.
Right.
Sorry. Okay. Well, that could be the case, sorry.
But you haven't heard it as you haven't. It hasn't come across your desk as yet.
No, not as yet. But if it does, you'll be the first to know.
Okay, thanks, Adam. I think that there's been some talk about that possibly happening today, but obviously hasn't happened yet. Adam Storey with the news headlines back at 1 o'clock. Thanks for that.
Okay.
Let's go to the weather details now. And Neil Fraser's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Hello, Michael.
So we're going to have a wet Easter in parts of the state.
No, not really. Not really. Well, there are exceptions to that, but
pockets. Generally
a lot of the state, it should be okay. Currently, the chart's got a strong high to the south of the Bight with a ridge pushing through to the Tasman Sea. So there's onshore flow, some showers, mainly just around the central parts of the coast, so sort of hunted down to the Illawarra region and pushing into some of the Blue Mountains areas and that. But generally, the rest of the state for today is dry. That shower activity along the coast will extend further north tomorrow, so just covering the northern half on Good Friday. There's a trough developing over Queensland, Northern Territory, South Australia, which is going to make things quite unstable through that part of the world. So expecting that to generate some severe thunderstorms for southwest Queensland, probably won't affect our far northwest tomorrow, but certainly on the weekend. So out of Tibooburra, they've got the Gymkhana happening on Saturday and Sunday, so they might be affected by some big thunderstorms, possibly some heavy rain with that. So it's unfortunate timing for them, because generally that part of the world is quite dry, but yeah, quite possibly heavy storms, as I said, Saturday and Sunday out through there. But for the rest of the state for Saturday and Sunday, apart from one or two showers about the far north coast, the rest should be dry. And even on Monday, still fairly dry through most areas. So all in all, I know Easter can be quite wet, but it's looking pretty good for most areas.
Yeah,
exception is the far northwest.
Earlier on, a few days ago, there was some concerns that we might see a bit of rain over Easter, but that seems to have, we seem to have backtracked on that now.
Well, it's going to be delayed. The models are backing off a bit too, so that system comes through on Monday in the southwest. But again, it's much weaker than it was indicating earlier. Yep. And then on Tuesday, looks like Tuesday is the biggest day for rainfall. Looks like the southern half, especially the southern half of the inland, might get some reasonable falls on Tuesday. So I'll be order of 10 to maybe 25 millimetres for Tuesday.
Yep.
But before then,
fairly widespread, you think?
Fairly widespread, yes.
Because a lot of those cropping areas, they'd like to see 25 or maybe even 50 millimetres to get going.
Yes, well, that's pushing it a bit. But certainly, Tuesday's the best day. Then it starts to contract to the coast for Wednesday and Thursday. So Tuesday, possibly much of inland, especially the southern half. But before then, unless you're out in the far northwest, like Tibooburra region west of Bourke, you won't get much rainfall. Well, you won't get anything right through the weekend.
And talking about when you're talking about the rainfall, will it be bringing rainfall, useful rainfall to the central west or up to Dubbo, or maybe not that far?
Well, the central west, they might not get too much, but as I said, Tuesday, central west, maybe at least 10 millimetres. But then there's going to be thunderstorms mixed in with it. So with thunderstorms, as you know, you can get much heavier falls in a localised area. But if we're talking broad average, then I'd say maybe 10 on Tuesday. But before then, the central west is going to remain quite dry, even on Monday.
It's been very dry there. And the Hunter Valley too, in the north too, they'd like a bit of rain there too. That doesn't sound like it's going to get up that far.
No, the upper Hunter probably won't get too much. Not until we get through to Tuesday, Wednesday next week.
Right, okay. And just hope for some thunderstorms, I guess.
That's right, yes.
Mm. All right, Neil, thanks for that.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
It's 18 minutes to one on the Country Hour.
Hello, I'm Rachel Mealy. Join me for The World Today. A tinderbox waiting to blow is how one Alice Springs councillor has described the central Australian town after the first night of a government-imposed curfew. What long-term solutions are being considered? And an AFL Grand Final rematch kicks off tonight, but the focus is once again off-field. The AFL's drugs policy is in the spotlight. The World Today at lunchtime.
And on the Country Hour, broadcasting today from the Food Dome. We're right in front of the Northern District exhibit, which looks fantastic. They won the overall prize. The exhibit for the Central Districts won the prize for the display, and you can see why, because they put a lot of time and effort into thinking about that one, with a sort of snakes and ladders type theme, I think, and also focusing on the youth, the young people involved in the show society there in the Central Districts. You're listening to The Country Hour, broadcasting, as I said, from the Food Dome here at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. Now, let's move away from the show, because a Mildura wine company and its manager have been fined almost $500,000 for illegally tapping into a pipeline and stealing the water. David Latore and Jindalee Road Wines, the company he managed at the time, faced the New South Wales Land and Environment Court this week, charged with illegally taking about 365,000 megalitres of water valued at more than $300,000. The legal action was brought by the Natural Resources Access Regulator. Director of Investigations and Enforcement, Lisa Stockley, told Angus Verley this is the biggest fine they've ever handed down.
This is actually the first time that we have prosecuted offences under Section 342 and 343 of the Water Management Act, which relate to the interference with public or private works and taking water from public or private works. So first prosecution of that nature. And in relation to the offences, the court handed down a penalty for the company involved of $326,500. And in relation to the former vineyard manager involved in the conduct, $172,500. And that's in addition to the payment of court costs of $95,000. So quite almost $500,000 in fines, quite a significant penalty imposed by the court in relation to this very serious offence under the Water Management Act.
And the nature of the offending, this vineyard manager essentially excavated the Water Authority's pipelines, bypassed water meters so that he was able to take irrigation water without it being metered and therefore not having to pay for it?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Angus. There was pipes that were used to tap into the main supply line, which is owned by Western Murray Irrigation, so it could bypass the metering equipment, which was operated via valve downstream of WMI's outlet meters. So the pipes were buried underground and it allowed the unmetered water take to be used for irrigation over a period of years without detection. The offending period actually was between 2016 and 2019 at two separate vineyards, but it didn't come to light until March 2020 when Western Murray Irrigation detected anomalies in their meter readings and did some further inquiries and uncovered tampering, which they then reported to NRAR in March of 2020. But the defendants actually, after the investigation commenced, purchased 1,800 megalitres on the temporary allocation market and transferred it back to WMI, which cost over $900,000 plus another over $100,000 in fees, and the amount of water that they transferred back exceeded the total that they'd been taken. So the court does take into account contrition and remorse, but they also did take into account the fact that these offences were intentional and committed for financial benefit by the company and the individual.
That was NRAR's Director of Investigations and Enforcement, Lisa Stockley, speaking with Angus Verley. Now, Nature Conservation Council water campaigner Mel Gray says the penalty handed down by the Land and Environment Court was inadequate.
Stealing water has significant impact on the rivers at a time when the rivers can least afford to lose that water. Those low flows in times of drought are hypercritical, super critical to keeping the system going. This community will just not accept large-scale water theft, and these large-scale water thieves need to lose their licence.
Mm. What would be a better way to calculate the penalties for water theft, do you think?
Well, there is a review underway at the moment for improving the way that fines are calculated for water theft. And it's important to know also that when water is stolen in dry times, the value of that water is far higher than in wet times. So that needs to be taken into account as well.
That's Nature Conservation Council water campaigner Mel Gray speaking to Elsie Kennedy. And we were talking a little bit earlier about wine as well. The Prime Minister apparently is about to make some announcement, or there's talk that he will be making some announcement about the tariffs and the China tariff situation. I understand that our reporter Amelia Bernasconi has been talking to the Hunter MP Dan Rapaccioli about this and asked him what is happening with China and wine.
So I got some exciting announcements coming out at Brokenwood today. The PM and I are going there, as well as a few of our other parliamentary colleagues as well. So we'll have to just wait and see, but it will be exciting for the Australian wine industry.
Well, it's the last day really today to lodge the WTO action again, so it sounds positive.
Does sound positive, but we just got to wait until the words come out of the PM's mouth and see where we end up.
Okay, so that obviously hasn't happened yet, so I was just asking Adam's story about that in the news, and they don't have the detail of that in regards to the China tariffs as yet. You're listening to The Country Hour. We're broadcasting from the Food Dome here at the Sydney Royal Easter Show, and it's coming up to 10 minutes to one.
Hi, my name's Joe Dorman. We've been exhibiting here at Sydney Royal Easter Show for 30-odd years. We show harness ponies and horses. You're listening to Country Hour.
And talking about the issue of, we're in the food pavilion at the moment, we're food dome, but just across the way is the goat pavilion. And I understand that it's full of mini goats at the moment, and I'm joined here by Sue Ludwig, who's been involved in the mini goat industry for quite some time, come all the way from Queensland.
Hi Michael, Sue Ludwig from the Miniature Goat Breeders Association, and we have come up from Queensland. We have some fabulous breeders that have actually come across from Tasmania as well.
Yeah, I gather they got on the ferry. And
they did, yeah, with their little goats and brought them across to this fabulous show.
Now, you've been involved in this industry for quite some time. How did you get involved, and what was it about the miniature goats?
So I actually started the breed about 29 years ago. They were pets to start with. They are pets now. We've built an industry off of these little fellows. They are absolutely fabulous family pets. There's a lot of them that will actually milk, and people are producing cheese and soaps and things.
Right, okay, so so there is a commercial side to it, but they started out as pets.
They certainly did.
Where did you get the idea from then, from overseas?
No. We were doing goat rescue back in 1995, and we had a lot of little ones come through, and they were quite skinny, and I decided that I wanted to breed little goats, but I wanted to breed them with a little bit more muscling on them. So we selected some really nice Bora goats and crossed them with the little ferals and the cashmeres, and we actually produced some beautifully coloured little goats that were fabulous for the family.
And obviously the reception here, the kids seem to love them at
the show. The kids love them. They're very safe for the kids. We disbud them so they don't have their horns, which is a big bonus. And they're very, very easy to handle. They're very, very easy to keep in. They being so small, they don't tend to jump the fences.
And I guess the other thing too is that it's a breeding. It's also you did it from a pet sort of focus initially, but also it's been a breeding exercise for you as well.
Yes,
yeah.
It's a boutique market now. We've had imports of pygmy goats and Nigerian dwarf goats that have come in around 2014.
So there are other breeds overseas.
We have got other breeds. Yep. We're importing them from America at the moment. So we now have not only the Australian miniature goats, but we have the pygmy goats and the Nigerian dwarf goats, which you'll see today and tomorrow. And we have our own newbie goat, and they're the ones that have the long ears.
Right. And is there judging in?
Yes, we've got an American judge that's come over. He is fabulous, Kurt Schnipke. He is from Ohio, I believe. He's been wonderful down there, very informative. He's a great speaker, and he's engaging with the public and letting everybody know all the parts of the goats, which is always very handy.
Okay, and so there is a dairy side to things as well. There is the soap side as well.
There is, and they are a show goat, so confirmation is very important. The really good confirmation ensures that they have a really good long life. They need to be able to walk around the paddocks, and they need to be able to breed easily and safely. And we've selected them very carefully to make sure that they can do that with their conformation.
I was just thinking, so yeah, if there are other breeds like that are the miniature goats in the wild, why would they have a miniature version of a goat in the wild?
So in the wild, not so much miniature, but they do have small ones in the wild. Sometimes they're nutritionally challenged.
Right.
We have had a few of those little ferals come in that haven't had the nutrition of our own homebred ones. They tend to throw and have big babies, though. So once you bring them in and you start feeding them, their babies actually grow quite big. So you've got to be very careful to choose genetically small animals and not nutritionally stunted animals.
Right.
And the only way you can tell that is by doing the breeding.
By doing the breeding but you'll know too in the feeding process.
Correct.
As well once that starts.
Correct.
Happening. Yeah.
And our breeders are very, very fussy with their animals. We are very, very good with our health and the well-being of the animals. And we're very lucky actually, because we've got health screen who are also good for health, but they're actually looking after us now. So rather than us just concentrating on the health of our little goats, we can concentrate on the health of ourselves too. So they've very kindly supported the show for us this year. And we're very lucky with that, helping us to bring this marvellous judge over.
Well, and it wouldn't be a cheap process. You've come down from, you had a convoy of cars.
Correct.
Coming down from Queensland.
From Queensland.
We had that convoy coming up from Tasmania.
That's
getting
right.
On the ferry with the goats as
yes.
Well.
Yes. So a lot of money,
lot of
and
logistics.
We've had a fabulous sponsors. So we're very, very grateful for them. And we've been able to get out to the public and let them see these beautiful animals.
And how many kids and parents come up and say, can I have one of those in the backyard?
We have a lot of people asking.
You do, yeah.
We do.
But I would imagine that takes a fair bit of looking after.
They're not as hard as you would think. They're quite easy to keep, but not really in a backyard. They need a little bit more than just a suburban backyard. A little bit of an area to run around in, so a bit of a paddock, an acre or so, a couple of acres is really good. And then we feed ours, so they're given all sorts of different hay and a little bit of grain and all the vitamins and minerals that they require as well.
Well, look, I'll let you get back to it because I know that there's quite a bit of interest. A lot of kids were milling around looking
kids
at the miniature
goats. Kids are
fabulous.
Yep. The kids love the kids.
And you see them jumping. They do jump around, don't they?
They do jump
yep.
around and their little ears fly all over the place.
Yep.
Well, so, they're fabulous and they're great for the little generations coming up of human children. So,
Thinking about the goats. All right, well, look, I appreciate your time on the Country Hour today.
Thank you very much. Lovely to meet you.
Sue Ludwig there, who's brought her mini goats down from Queensland for the judging here at the Sydney Royal Show. Now, before we go, just letting you know, don't seem to have too many markets in yet because of the Easter holiday, so nothing from Armidale and Dubbo, so looks as though we might not have any markets today on the Country Hour because of that. But we're joined now, we're right here in the District Exhibits area. We're joined now by Ken Hewitt from the Southern Districts. Not the winners this time, but tell us about getting organised and getting ready for the show. It's always a fabulous time.
Yeah, it takes a bit of time together, and you gather all your produce from different areas and different areas, some work and some don't. And like this year, our pumpkins, we never got any from the South Coast.
Is that right?
From Nowra right through to Bega. And but
why,
we had a people.
Why was that? What was that?
Well, just the climate conditions and everything else. They just never grew the big pumpkins this year, and no one had them. The season didn't work for them. But luckily, we had people at Nangus near Gundagai, and they grew a heap for us. And so you always get, if you grow them in different areas, you'll get someone to pull through for you. So
well, we have had weather play a part for the northern guys when they had flooding and their produce and things for a couple of years too. So we have seen that it really does impact, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was the dry that impacted the dry earlier on. It was very dry down there early, and it wasn't until November before they got the rain, and then things come good and everything's growing now, but it's too late for the show. Like it's just the way it works out. And so you roll with the punches, and that's the way you do it.
And Southern Districts, would a big part of that be grain as well for you guys, the grain growers?
The grain guys done very well this year. Like, it was just a bit drier out there, and it worked well for us this year. And we go from Young right through to the Victorian border, and there's a big grain area right through that area, and it's very good. We have a good bloke to go and collect it all for us and source all the good products out.
Yeah, because quite often you go to these individual specialists, don't you, to get the best ones?
You do, yeah. We go over, the word gets out and for all the areas and they get to know, and we have people in different areas right through that they source the high protein grains that comes in, they keep it aside for us, and we use it then. So.
And what about the fruit and veg? Like we said, the northern, they seem to have a real focus on that. Is it
they
more
do.
Difficult for you?
Yeah, it is a bit difficult. We have a lot of areas around Kemps Creek and in the Sydney area and down the south coast. A lot of our vegetables come from down there, and because they were pretty good this year, the vegetables, and you know, they done all right. They were the big pumpkins a bit early, and the other pumpkins are too early. But a lot of your vegetables, there was just a nick of time to grow them, and they come good. So.
And of course, the southern areas, you know, wool's an important part of the
wool.
So,
yeah, we grow our wool from the southern tablelands, sort of from the Crookwell area right through to the Monero, and that's where our better wool, our high yearling wools, come from. And and they work out all right. We can go from super fines and ultra fines right through to the strong wools.
So that's why it is an important part of the exhibit as well, because it's an important part of the region.
Yeah, every region's got to have a different area, and with your high rainfall, low rainfall, and different paths to get the produce, because it's a wide variety of produce.
Absolutely.
There's 5 days of judging, like from your hams, bacons, your wines. And
of course, the display as well, which people spend a lot of time on. Ken, thanks very much for your time on the program today.
Okay, Michael, thank you.
You're listening to The Country Hour. That's where we're going to finish our coverage this year, live from the Sydney Royal Easter Show, but we'll have more on Monday. Talk to you then. It's 1 o'clock.